After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Hello and welcome to the Metta Hour podcast with Sharon Salzberg. I'm Lily Cushman. I produce this podcast, and we're returning today to our ongoing mental health series here on the Metta Hour for episode 227, a conversation with Harvard-trained psychiatrist, Columbia-trained Buddhist scholar, the assistant professor of clinical psychiatry and integrative medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College, and the founder of Nalanda Institute, Joe Luizzo. Joe has 40 years' experience studying both Eastern and Western approaches to mental health, and we've been working on lining up this interview for him to be part of the mental health series for quite some time. I'm so happy it finally came together. The conversation starts with Joe's background, how he came to the field of mental health, and also just how that field has evolved to where we are now. Both he and Sharon discuss a lot of interesting nuance to mental health care plans and the stigma around treatment, as well as how much the events on the larger world stage affect the personal, and also Joe's impetus for founding Nalanda Institute, all the great work that the Institute is doing. There's also some fun backstory here about this pivotal role that Joe played in Sharon's early teaching career. And as always, some of the tools that we can apply to learn how to work with our minds and the compassionate approach to the human condition. And as always, you can check our show notes for some different mental health resources, links that our different guests on this series have recommended, and you're in for a great conversation. Before we get to that, a short announcement. Sharon has a bunch of virtual events she's doing in the coming months. I encourage you to check out her teaching schedule. And one of those is happening on November 13th, a six-week online course that is being hosted by Tricycle Online. It is the Real Life course. And this course is really a deep dive into the teachings of Sharon's book by the same name that came out earlier this spring. So if you are looking for a way to go deeper with that book, these teachings of working with states of contraction and isolation and moving into expansion, this course may be for you. So you can visit SharonSalzberg.com and there's information to register there. So let's get to today's episode. Joe Luizzo and Sharon Salzberg.
Hello, Joan. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Sharon. So lovely to hear your voice.
It's lovely to hear yours. How are you? Where are you recording from today?
From Manhattan, from our home in Lenape Land, overlooking the Hudson.
Nice. So we are recording this in October of 2023. There's a tremendous amount of suffering in the conflict in the Middle East. Feels important to mention as it's on so many people's hearts and minds. And, you know, I realize that there are many people who just in their daily lives feel as if they're in a war zone. That's important to acknowledge as well. It's good to come together today, and especially in these times of tremendous conflict and distress, talk about how we can support ourselves and ultimately support one another in this very complicated world. So, Joe, you and I have known each other for a long time now. You've been in the field of mental health for much of your career. You're a psychiatrist and a clinical researcher with a focus on integrating neuroscience with contemplative practice. And since this episode is a part of what we're calling our mental health series here on the podcast, we'll be centering around those topics. So I'd love to hear more about your journey in this field and how you came to be interested in psychiatry.
Okay, that's a big question. I think I mentioned that I consider myself kind of the product of a double-blind experiment, right? Because my parents took different avenues or paths in responding to the challenge of being immigrants in the U.S., Italian background. And my dad became kind of assimilated, became a psychiatrist. So sometimes I say my profession is an inherited condition. But my mom chose to be a teacher. And well, he kind of gave up his spirituality and became more sort of science-oriented. She stayed very close to her Catholic roots, was very quiet about it, but it clearly I sort of followed their trajectories, and where he got more and more burnt out. He loved his work. It was really fascinating having people come and go in his home office. I could see them really sitting in there talking. I thought, well, what a nice way to work. You know, you just spend your time having conversations, and everybody seemed to enjoy it. At the same time, I think the emotional stress slowly burned him out. And whereas my mom seemed to get better with age. So I thought, well, there must be something in what she's doing. I want some of what she has, right? It was pretty early in my teens. I started reading Jung and felt like there must be some way to reintegrate spirituality or contemplative life back into modern life. And psychotherapy seemed a kind of potential bridge. So that's kind of how I got started. Then the rest of the journey really kind of got more complicated from there.
Well, the field of psychiatry itself has evolved so much in the past decades and is still evolving. And I'm sure you've seen lots and lots of changes when you first began studying. So I wonder if you can speak to that. And certainly there have been a lot of changes in terms of the incorporation or acceptance of contemplative practice.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say overall for my field, you know, the time that I became aware of psychiatry and psychotherapy in the 60s and 70s, it was a very vibrant time for the field. There was the sort of influx of psychoanalysis. People were writing, you know, like Eric Fromm and Viktor Frankl and, you know, Rollo May. There was a real interest in popular health, kind of the culture, and infusing some kind of existential wisdom or larger kind of positive outlook into our way of life. And I would say pretty much starting about as I went into medical school and residency, the field started shifting very much in the opposite direction. It's exactly where I didn't want it to go. Instead of getting more involved in kind of channeling spiritual contemplative wisdom practice and ethics, it got more and more materialistic, more and more reductionistic. And I think, unfortunately, my colleagues have kind of taken, you know, I don't want to be too dramatic about it, but I really feel like they've trashed the discipline by kind of in a way, you could say, getting too enamored of the quick fix and the psychopharmacology. You could also say selling out in a way, because we know that, of course, that's an industry.
Uh-huh.
I do think one of the hopeful things about the confluence of Western psychotherapy and largely Buddhist contemplative practice, but contemplative practice in general, is that it is kind of bucking the trend. And that plus the new discovery of neuroplasticity, which is kind of given a little more sciency kind of grounding or credibility to the simple thing of talking to others or doing things like meditating, that's also helping. So my hope is that the field is going to have a little renaissance and move more toward, back toward the psyche, toward the spirit and the soul, human, mind and soul, and away from drugs,
Well, I'm very curious about these times and whether, when there are just devastating things happening in the world, do you find that people are somewhat less likely to try to get personal help for their own dilemma in these tumultuous times, because it feels like their own suffering just cannot measure up to the awful, awful experience others are having?
I may have a kind of biased perspective, because people, who come to me are self-selected.
Yeah.
But I feel it's more like the opposite, that people, bring their personal angst, and part of their personal angst is the collective angst.
Uh-huh.
So that I do think that there's a kind of breaking down of the sense of the barriers. I think the hyper-individualism of the U.S. culture, and especially kind of since the baby boom era, the whole kind of last decades, people are becoming more aware of our interconnection with others and the need for, the culture to change. I mean, of course, the culture has also gone over the cliff in so many ways. It's become much clearer that our problems are not just personal. I think that people are bringing in their issues with, the collective traumas that are happening and how it activates them. And whether that be in the realm of, racial trauma, gender, patriarchy, and which is on the rise, or it be ethnic conflict or religious conflict, it's a lot of these themes are coming up, and to me that's very welcome, because I do think that we've overestimated in modern psychotherapy and psychology, as in modern science and culture in general, we've overestimated how the how separate we are, and like the Buddhist wisdom is kind of being acknowledged that we're really such communal, connected animals, that we're suffering with one another and not just with our own family or psyche.
And on that note, I'm going to ask you a question I've asked for probably more than 30 years when I've been on different panels and such with psychotherapists, which is basically the question is your envisioning like a care plan for a client, a patient, does it ever involve like service or taking care of others or finding a way to help someone else?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, in the sense that, first of all, I mean, I think our health and well-being, one of the beautiful things about, the cross-validation, like in the last two or three decades, a lot of domains in science and neuroscience and psychology have been validating sort of ancient contemplative spiritual values. So the whole idea of the importance of love and of loving connection, whether it be with individuals or community, is really becoming, you know, increasingly kind of something we can talk about and something people are aware of. And so a lot of what I do has to do with helping people work on their relationships with others in the world to try to take some of the alienation and trauma out of it, and to try to develop more empathy, more, you know, skillful compassion, not necessarily wise compassion, as they said, not necessarily sentimental, but recognizing how important it is to try to shift the quality of our engagement with others. And so, yeah, part of that might be really supporting people in their wish to make a difference. You know, so it starts with taking care of themselves, obviously, right? But, pretty soon that's like learning, because that's so interconnected with relationships, it's learning how to navigate complicated relationships with partners, with kids, with loved ones. But then we're talking about, you know, how do you engage with the world, with the institutions around you, with your professional life? And I do think that for me, change really starts to get to happen and get more positive when people realize that contributing, being part of, you know, the change you want to see, to use the cliche, right? To, you know, trying to kind of commit oneself to, you know, the kind of doing something helpful for oneself, really helpful in the sense of not the way we live, not just simply fitting into the cog of the machine that's heading over the cliff, but really trying to resist that and find ways of being in community or at work or with, in your career that are adding to a greater sense of responsibility for the culture we live in, for the planet we live on. You know, so I think that's, I'm not one for plans, because I think it's a journey, and I tend to follow the lead of, you know, where people are evolving. Uh-huh. But I think when things are really clicking, when I know we're on the right channel, is when people are thinking about how to heal their relationships with others and with the world, and I'd say the planet and history and all of those things.
That's beautiful. And historically, you know, in a way connected to that, because treating one's mental health sometimes feels removed from day-to-day life, which of course it's really not. But historically, there's a tremendous amount of stigma around mental health care. Even the term mental health is now one of my new bugaboos, you know, because I was talking to somebody the other day and I was saying, really, we're not talking about mental health. You know, we're talking about feeling a lack of mental health or, you know, a great imbalance in our mental state, but we can't call it anything other than mental health because it wouldn't look pretty enough or something. So historically, there's a tremendous amount of stigma around mental health care, which feels like it's shifting in a big way, perhaps in current time with Gen Z. And what do you see in that regard?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think this part of our hyper-individual culture has been to kind of pretend that we're all separate and that we, you know, that our happiness depends, you know, like on our actions alone. And the flip side of that is our suffering is separate and our suffering depends on somehow it's our fault. You know what I mean? Yeah. If we're suffering in mind or heart or body or whatever, nervous system. And so I think that, and, you know, unfortunately, one of the side effects of our hyper-individualist culture and of our kind of Calvinist, like capitalist culture of, like, you know, what real happiness is, you know, being crushing it in the world, being super successful, you know, having your ego blown up and your bank account blown up, you know, I think is that people who don't really, who are either oppressed by that system because they just don't, they're not in the club, or they're not in the, whether it's racially, gender wise, or culturally, whatever, or people who don't really want that, like who don't have it in them to go out and crush things, you know, get stigmatized. And so I think, first of all, that there's a lot of research in terms of modern stress psychology and positive psychology from both sides to show that a lot of things we diagnose as mental disorders, quote unquote, are actually the function, are actually products of chronic exposure to stress and trauma. Mm. And that chronic exposure to stress and trauma isn't just individual childhood. It's also social environment, cultural environment. So I think what a lot of people are really waking up to is challenging this whole notion of sort of blaming the individual, the mental health in a way has this tendency to label and personalize, to privatize suffering as if it's in you. And to add, as you pointed out, this negative valuation, like if you're sensitive, if you're the canary in the coal mine and you're not happy, you're not thriving in a dysfunctional, violent world, then there's something wrong with you. Mm. You know what I mean? So I think I have strong feelings about this. I mean, I think that the tide is turning and people are becoming much more aware that, you know, of how sensitive we are to the toxic elements in our culture, in our lifestyle, in our environment. And part of that is less, I do think in the younger generation, like I know with my kids, I have two, one 18-year-old and one 21-year-old. And their generation, you know, is much more upfront about, yeah, I got this and I got that and I'm taking this and I'm taking that. And here's what, you know, my family situation is. So I think that there's both a kind of greater acceptance that we're human and we all have, vulnerabilities, and also a recognition that part of the problem is that the way we're supposed to function is not healthy or is violent or is harmful. Mm-hmm. And so in school is a perfect example, you know, like I was just talking to somebody who works at the Columbia University Health Center, mentioned that there were 4 suicides.
Yeah.
And, you know, why is that? Like, is it those kids have a mental problem? I mean, you know, it's very clear that we're not creating an environment where people feel safe and have joy, and quite the opposite. And then you put that together with, you know, hey, we're actually destroying the planet. You know, you kind of, the picture, it's becoming clearer that there's something fundamentally wrong with the way we've been living and what we expect of people, and that the people who have for a long time been gaslighted or stigmatized as, hey, what's wrong with you? You know, we now can maybe see more clearly, we're just, you know, often in many ways impacted negatively, you know, we're the canaries in the coal mine of a system that was harmful and maybe, also really kind of are conscientious objectors too, in a way, like just don't want to be part of something that really is, you know, kind of not very constructive or humane.
Well, there's so much blame, you know, that's so unjust. Like I think of listening to you, I'm thinking of Diego Perez, or Young Pueblo, it's his pen name, who was on the podcast. And he said that the most traumatic thing he had lived through in his life was not a kind of sudden, sharp incident. It was kind of the chronic poverty within which he grew up. And that left a real mark. So I was thinking, listening to, we blame the kid even, you know, for being poor and sort of look down on them and somewhat disdainful of them. Then we blame the now older kid for responding to that trauma, you know, taking drugs or whatever they're doing, is what in his case it was that, till he began meditating. And so, it's just a strange environment. Instead of saying, this is a survivor, you know, look at that.
Exactly. I totally agree. And I think, unfortunately, my profession has, I'm talking about psychiatry in particular, although I think generally this is true of most mainstream mental health, has kind of been, has drunk the Kool-Aid and has gone along acting as if, labeling people as if it's really true that they have ADHD or they're oppositional or they're the story begins and ends that they're an addict or whatever, or they have depression, and really are not looking at the context of the larger cultural, social, familial kind of legacies that really have, we know from research, like they have so much to do, like our really primary inputs in terms of our development. So, you know, and you see it in little ways, just in terms of, you know, young kids, you know, kids going into middle school and high school. I have a lot of clients who have, you know, kids at that age. Mm-hmm. And the pressures, you know, the system, you know, gives, it puts such a kind of a burden on them of hyper performance. And if they're, you know, they're staying up and, you know, all hours. You know, if they happen to be, you know, boys who are, you know, not nerdy and, you know, kind of normal physical animals or, you know, girls who want safe connection with their peers or whatever, the system is really telling them there's something wrong with them. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, and it's really compounding the problem, which I think is part of the reason why, you know, we have such a quote unquote mental health crisis, you know.
So in 2007, seems like a million years ago, you founded the Nalanda Institute for Contemplative Science, an educational nonprofit. So maybe you can tell us more about that work.
Yeah. So Nalanda Institute is the kind of the outcome or the fruition of my, you know, path, you know, my sort of, you know, odd path or whatever road not taken of trying to bring together, you know, mental health and these kinds of considerations of what's a sane way of living, together with the Buddhist tradition. Particularly, I was raised in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and hence the word Nalanda refers to the world's first university, Nalanda University in North India, which gave rise to the form of Buddhism that later spread to Tibet, and hence, you know, the Dalai Lama and other Tibetans often think of Tibetan Buddhism as the Nalanda tradition. But I founded it. After many years of having to keep my interests a secret from my mental health peers because they would diagnose me and put me in whatever, given the John Kabat-Zinn and some basic research, the discovery of neuroplasticity and everything, by the time, then in the 90s, Buddhism became popular and mindfulness became an acceptable or even cool thing in mental health. At the time, I was at Columbia. I was doing graduate studies in Tibetan, and it was also in the psychiatry department. And they asked me to found a center I call it the Center for Meditation and Healing at Columbia. But very soon I realized that the corporation, the hospital was not a place where we could have the kind of space, a safe space to explore all the things that we need to explore and to connect in the ways we need to connect. I sometimes, you know, remember and kind of the remember the irony that in the psychiatry department, I could teach meditation because now it was cool, but I couldn't teach the Dharma. I couldn't teach ethics or philosophy or psychology from Buddhism. In the religion department, I could teach ethics and philosophy and psychology, but I couldn't teach people to actually do anything about it, like meditate or change their life. So that just gives you a flavor for how, you know, even in the sort of very fancy academic, you know, institution, there really wasn't room for the heart or the whole human being to learn a new way of being human. So that's part of why I founded the Institute, was to create a space that was sort of off the grid a little bit of the corporate culture and the kind of knowledge production engines and all of that that have taken over academia. And the Institute has been, you know, it's been a great gift because it's been a kind of open community where people like you come and teach, and I get to sort of continue to connect and dialogue with like-minded peers who are trying to make a shift in our way of being. And also, obviously, people, the students from all different backgrounds who really don't just want to, do sort of simple mindfulness, right? Like the kind of the pop vanilla, mm-hmm. Want to go deeper or want to learn the psychology or want to really learn the ethics or be in a community where they can really experiment with their way of being and connecting. And so we have really, as you know, like awesome students who are really kind of looking for something that's heading in a different direction, let's say.
That's fantastic. I don't want to go further without giving you due honor for the tremendous influence you've had in my own life, which was these many years ago. I don't know if we'd ever met, actually, but I had a friend who was coming out of a kind of long hospitalization for a psychiatric condition at Columbia. And I was looking through some booklet or something like that, and I saw you were teaching an aftercare program in meditation. And I wanted to be able to accompany my friend to these classes. He very much wanted to go, but I didn't want to have to pay because it was quite expensive since it wasn't covered by my insurance. And so I called you and left you a message. And I said, I'm Sharon Salzberg, and I've been meditating a long time myself, but I wonder how you would feel about my coming along with my friend and auditing this class. I'm so happy you're offering it. And it seemed like a great set of skills for people to have as they were leaving more of a crisis situation and coming back into the world. And left your message, and you called me back, and you said to me, why don't you teach them? And I thought, oh, I could teach them. And so a friend offered me an apartment in New York, and I spent 6 months in New York, and I had this little sitting group, which was like 4 or 5 people, which was included this friend, and it changed my entire life. So thank you. And I'm wondering, is that more common now that people might be offered those kinds of tools?
Yeah, and thank you so much for reminding me of that. And and it's an honor to be involved in any way in your trajectory, because we're all so grateful to you for the voice and the humanity you brought to this to the world, but specifically to the culture of contemplative life in the U.S.
Thank you.
I do think that part of where we live at Nalanda Institute, and I think this is not just unique to my community or our community, but it's true of the movement in general, is that there is a kind of blurring because there's so much adoption in mental health of mindfulness and now self-compassion and maybe even compassion practices. That there's a lot of people who are not mental health professionals who are either yoga teachers or meditation teachers or coaches who use these things or teachers who use these things or human resource people who use them. And so there's a much more of a, one of the beautiful things about the culture of contemplative, practice and is that it is much more empowering. It's not so professionalized. It's not so like, hey, you have to have these you know, things on the wall. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that a lot of our students who, from many different backgrounds and not just mental health backgrounds, are finding ways to be helpful and to bring what they've learned in their own life about contemplative practice to others. And we very much support that because, you know, it can't just be a professionalized thing. Like, we all need this medicine. It has to be, we all have to learn, you know, how to share what's helped us, right? I mean, like, there's so much help is needed.
Mm-hmm. That's for sure. And that actually opens up the next thing I was going to ask you, which is an impossible question, but maybe it makes it more specific. So it's almost like what's the contrast between Buddhist psychology and more Western psychology as an approach? But one of the differences, I get asked that, you know, all the time. Well, I bet not as much as you. You know, one of the differences would be just that. It would be, okay, what can I as an individual do, you know, today about my life in a real sense of tools? You know, I have some basic tools that I can use. And another distinction, I don't know if it's a distinction because I know much more about Buddhist psychology or Eastern psychology than Western. But, you know, as I was taught as a meditation student, you know, ways of sitting with painful feeling, whether it's emotional pain or physical pain, at the same time not being defined by the pain, not judging myself for what I was feeling, and because of that non-judgment, being able to look more deeply into it. So if I was feeling a great deal of craving and desire and I could sit with it and look at it, maybe I'd find a lot of loneliness inside of it, or sitting, you know, seething with anger, and I could sit and be with it, I'd find kind of the helplessness, sense of helplessness that was at its core. No matter what I was feeling, being able to see directly the impermanent nature of it. And so that doesn't mean invalidating the feeling, but it's creating a different context within which we experience it, a context of awareness and compassion. So I'm wondering if that resembles the process of healing from the Western psychotherapeutic perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there's so many, the traditions are so incredibly kind of uncannily similar in a lot of ways, and yet obviously there's real differences. So I think that, you know, you can often, one way to think about what, how the two relate is that in a way, therapy is kind of like an assisted meditation. You know what I mean? Like, you have somebody else who's kind of helping you get into a meditative relationship with yourself and teaching you how to be with and observe and tolerate your own suffering. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully what often doesn't get emphasized is that you learn how to do it yourself. Mm-hmm. And of course, the beautiful thing about the contemplative traditions is there's much less stigma or pathologizing. Suffering is really much more embraced, welcomed as not abnormal, something to be feared and labeled and killed off, mm-hmm. but as just part of reality that maybe can be approached in a way that is generative or that is healing, that gives us information. Or so there's that depathologizing and kind of fundamentally positive message in the Buddhist psychology that we can really deal with our suffering, whatever it is, and we can also transform it and grow beyond it or tolerate it in a way that allows us to still thrive. And then all the tools that come in the Buddhist tradition to help us do that, it's like, you know, instead of just being a patient, quote unquote, you know, like that there's somebody who's not active or not an agent, Buddhist psychology really prepares you to actively engage with your suffering, which we're not all ready to do all the time. Like, so the nice thing about Western psychology is there's a lot more personalized, individualized help and support than you often find in Buddhist communities, where it's more about teaching large groups or large groups, you know, kind of being human together, trying to deal with human suffering as a collective condition. So, it's nice, you know, to have that kind of individualized attention to how did you suffer, and the kind of support is something that might only be found in the Buddhist medical system rather than in Buddhist psychology per se. But I think the two traditions really reinforce each other in a lot of ways, because I do think that the emphasis on kind of going deeper into the personal psyche with help from others, like having a really close, I think of therapy as having a really close relationship with your teacher.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And some of us are lucky enough to have that, but most people that study the Dharma in Asia, as in the West, just have classes.
Yeah.
And then it never gets very individualized. And so I also think that there's something unique about the Western approach to understanding our childhood and the early development, that does help kind of share the suffering a little bit, like the specifics of the suffering, the specific story. But again, like a good teacher would do that anyway. A good Buddhist teacher would do that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think the two, you know, overall, I would say what Buddhism brings is a much more optimistic relationship with suffering.
Yeah.
And a much more optimistic sense of our capacity to hold it, so that it doesn't have to be like, gee, you know, I can't handle this. I have to, only my therapist can handle it.
Right.
And also it brings, to make that kind of a reality, it brings the tools and the trainings that strengthen us, so that in a way we're almost like our own little mental health professional in our own mind, which has always been true. One of the beautiful things about Buddhist learning is that medicine and healing has always been seen as part of the basic training, because there was an understanding that to be a meditator, to be a healthy, successful contemplative, you know, finding happiness or whatever awareness, you needed to know about your health and heal yourself. And I think the same relationship exists in terms of the learning how to deal with your own negativity. But the optimism comes from a sense that, again, there's something about the Western medical model which tends to kind of pathologize and otherize or demonize in a way, like suffering, as if, oh, you've got this like a cancer.
Yeah.
You know, and we just got to get it out. Like, you can't have that in your mind, or you have it in mind. Oh, poor you, you have it in your mind. Whereas in Buddhism, there's really a sense that all mental suffering is just part of human life.
Yeah.
And it's not so bad. You know what I mean? Like, there's, you can have you can accept it and be in relationship with it, whatever it is, however dark, however convoluted, it isn't something that's beyond you or that you're powerless over. Yeah.
Yeah. Your awareness is stronger. Your compassion actually is stronger.
Yeah.
When it's applied. But we should talk sometime about demonizing cancer, which is another.
It is another topic for sure.
Yeah. Which is, all of this is really fascinating, because I hadn't really thought about modern Asia. I think more about, as you say, my experience has been a very close relationship with each of my teachers, you know, for over 50 years now, which is an amazing blessing, and it's uncommon, you know. It's just, and these days, you know, of course, they encounter people whose first and maybe long term acquaintance with meditation practices through an app.
Right.
And I was just talking to somebody the other day who works on such an app, and saying how, when at one point I was instructed, when I was guiding meditation on it, that I had to say a few words, and then every time I was becoming silent, I had to then say, now it's your turn to do this. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't really want to do that, you know, because like I'm myself meditating, I'm engendering to the best of my ability a certain energy. I don't want to interrupt that. I'm happy to say in the beginning, when I become silent, that's your signal to put into practice what I've just suggested or something to set the stage. But I don't want to keep saying it. And they said to me, you don't understand. Like people keep writing and saying things like, my app is broken. It's not working right at this minute, you know? And I was like, oh my gosh, you know, like that's different. And also, I mean, there's nothing that is comparable until we can do it ourselves, as you say, to somebody loving you no matter what, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there they are, and you're just closing whatever, and they're still there, which is kind of incredible. You know, thinking about all these many things, which, as far as I know, have come from the Eastern world, you know, self-compassion, mindfulness, emotional intelligence, actually, and how much the Eastern reality in terms of people meditating on their own and would be enhanced by either a personal relationship for some with a therapist, for some with a community, with a teacher, certainly, if that becomes available. And it really is like worlds coming together. And I want to just, in the few minutes we have left, talk about compassion and compassion for others, not only for ourselves. And something about our making assumptions of what anxiety looks like or what depression looks like, when in reality, when these are challenges that affect every population, regardless of circumstance, and we're kind of siloed from that. And if we could get that perspective, things would be different. And how do we get that perspective?
Yeah. Well, that's so, you know, I do think that there's gifts that each of these traditions, Western psychology, Buddhist psychology, are offering one another, that something, there's going to be an enrichment. And one of my initial sort of intents or fantasies or whatever, like visions of how these traditions could come together is, you know, and you have a lot of therapists getting cranked out of different, you know, training programs, and if they all really were deeply embedded in the cultural and in the culture and practice and wisdom of contemplative traditions, they could really be like conduits, you know, for this into the lay world, so that people, you know, didn't have to get an app or whatever. But you know, I think in terms of the importance of where we are in terms of understanding the compassionate approach to the human condition, that is one of the most beautiful elements of Buddhist culture, is, you know, that, yeah, I think that part of the pathologizing of things like anxiety or depression or trauma or whatever is that you feel like you have to keep it secret and other people aren't having it. And so what could be, you know, a great source of meaningful connection or even just understanding and compassion, like, why is that person so cranky today? Well, maybe maybe they have some of the same whatever anxiety or depression that I have, and I don't need to feel like I'm being personally threatened. I can have empathy, mm-hmm. you know. But you know, I think having that sense of, you know, overcoming, you know, the privatization of mental suffering and recognizing that we're all in it together. Mm-hmm. And in a way, part of modern I don't even think it's modern. I think a lot of, explanatory cultural systems tend to create and deal with our suffering or fear or whatever by demonizing other people and saying, you know, they're the bad ones. You know, they're the mm-hmm. not so human ones. And in the Buddhist culture, I feel like, you know, part of the way that this is, you know, very powerfully addressed or engaged is to sort of recognize that people are good. Basically, everybody's good. Like, this is, think about how we all come out of the womb, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not going to hurt anybody. But when we're controlled by destructive emotions that we don't understand and we can't, or delusions, confusions that we don't understand and we can't work with, we can't manage, we do harmful things to ourselves and others. And so the focus there becomes on understanding, not only do I feel compassion for people who are obviously weighed down by suffering, because I can feel like, yeah, we're all human, we all suffer together, so that my suffering can connect me to others and create a sense of commonality or solidarity. But also to recognize that a lot of the horrible things that are happening in the world are happening because people never learned how to understand and deal with their destructive, you know, the confusions and destructive emotions in their own mind. And so really having this, you know, bigger perspective, you know, that, you know, learning to understand our minds and work skillfully with our suffering isn't a luxury. It's an absolute necessity for all of us. And it isn't a private struggle. Like my personal, I have to deal with my anxiety. It's a collective, you know, challenge that if we don't all learn how to deal better with these confusions and emotions that afflict us all, that, you know, we're going to be living in a mess, in a war zone, in a zoo. Mm-hmm. And so I think that in that sense, it becomes more like, you know, the culture, Buddhism very specifically pinpoints the parts of our nature that are likely to cause us suffering, and does so in a way that doesn't shame or blame or personalize and say, oh, only you have this or only they have this, but says we all have this and we better come together to work together on getting over it, right? And so there's a kind of very powerful force of like wisdom or connection that could really be much more than any, because it has to do with such fundamental human qualities as, narcissism or rage or panic or trauma, that it really could cut across a lot of the boundaries of identity that often, you know, end up separating us and blocking our empathy. So I think that compassion is, you know, the mindfulness revolution was big. I think the compassion revolution is in a way even bigger because, you know, it's, well, I mean, I love the way you teach compassion, Sharon, and not many people teach it that way, that it has the essence, you know, I mean, that mindfulness has the essence of compassion in it. Mm-hmm. And that attention isn't, it's not just about paying attention. Mm-hmm. It's about paying attention with a heart, with a kind of quality of care. And if that way we understand in a way mindfulness is a form of compassion, and then there's this, you know, larger sense of compassion, stretching our compassion for ourselves to include all living beings, that there's a really important culture shift that has to happen. You can looking at the world today and probably any day we see, you know, this is one thing modern culture hasn't tried. Modern culture has tried to get rid of our contemplative traditions, right, and break away from them. And I think that's, you know, part of the problem that mm-hmm. we need to to kind of put them back in the center of our you know, values and you know, practices.
So maybe that's the I was going to ask you about next developments, what you saw coming. So maybe that is what you see coming, which would be really great. Like, I know psychedelics are a big conversation these days, and as this next generation more and more destigmatizes mental health, maybe calls it something else, more and more, we're heading for maybe, you know, really revolutionary times and certainly pioneering times.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, as far as psychedelics go, I do think that, you know, any way that we can discover the power of our minds or different capacities within our minds that are not normally accessible to us is a value, any experience that does that. But also there's the risk. And I've spoken to, I have a number of friends who are leading researchers in this area, and they're concerned too about the way our culture tends to fetishize pills and things outside of our mind. You know, and so from that point of view, I'm not so sure, like, it's not the panacea, because ultimately, like, you know, our brain is a psychedelic factory, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if we're not learning how to live in it and use it effectively, we can pump whatever we want into it, but we're not going to get what we want.
Yeah.
But I think that in terms of, you know, future developments, I mean, I do think that people becoming more savvy about what happiness is and about what real health and well-being is, and understanding that it's you know, something that we need education and training for, you know, that we need to invest in it. We can't, it's got to go beyond the app ultimately.
Yeah.
I think these are extremely important, and you know, I think I'm not a pessimist, because, you know, I remember when you and I started out, like, nobody knew about any of this stuff.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? And it was really weird. You know, people thought, like, what are you interested in? You know, so the fact that the culture has taken up these practices and this, you know, entertaining or, you know, exploring these other ways of looking at life and how to cope with suffering and how to cultivate real happiness, is like really a miracle. And it shows you what's possible, in terms of cultural evolution. And I think, you know, so I do think that, you know, on the horizon, I see more than, you know, the psychedelics per se. I think like in the Indian tradition, they ultimately at a certain point abandoned psychedelics. They used to use them. And then they decided to go with breathing.
Yeah.
So, you know, the next generation, like, in my view, as part of the Nalanda tradition, there's an understanding that there's the, you know, mindfulness working with our minds, compassion working with our hearts, and then there's these embodied approaches that involve speaking to our more primal layers of the nervous system, more usually unconscious, with breathing or movement or image or poetry. And that's, I think, a next wave, is looking at embodiment, because one of the new research areas that's kind of shifting the field as well is this notion, is the sort of research on trauma and understanding, again, how much of our suffering is really individually and collectively isn't like a diagnosis, you know, like, you know, you have a neurotransmitter imbalance, one of my least favorite fantasies, but it's like, no, you know, you've been exposed to chronic stress, or you've been exposed to chronic trauma. And that's where the embodied approaches maybe add a little extra oomph Mm-hmm. Right. And I think if you're living a monastic life, it's sort of taken care of because I know you talk a lot about walking meditation, right? Mm-hmm. And you're living a life that just behaviorally, like you have rituals, you have community, you have chanting, you know, you have a lot of things that are speaking to that older part of your mm-hmm. nervous system. Mm-hmm. But I think of the embodied practices as ways that you kind of create the monastery in your own life or in your own community by, you know, working in very consciously to help your body feel safe. And mm-hmm. And I think that's going to be a big horizon as well. Yeah. So, I think there's just like I said, you know, the incredible uptake and foment that you and I have seen. I expect it's going to continue apace, if not even faster. Mm-hmm. I think that another area, you know, in sort of growth area or important area in my view is because Buddhism has had a special affinity with science and psychology because it's always been among the spiritual traditions, some of the most focused on science and psychology. But I think bringing the other traditions, the other world contemplative mm-hmm. traditions or indigenous traditions into the dialogue mm-hmm. is also going to be a growth area because it isn't, we need to not just, give ourselves new awareness and skills. We need to kind of understand our conditioning and update, like the Dalai Lama says, your grandmother's religion, you know, we need to really understand how our culture was conditioned and how maybe our early childhood, if we didn't grow up with the Dharma, mm-hmm. And try to, and of course there are many cultures where, you know, contemplation comes in a different cultural matrix, you know, mm-hmm. in Sufism or Kabbalah or whatever it is, you know, Taoism. So, I'd love for those traditions to be as engaged in dialogue with Western science and psychotherapy as Buddhism has been, right? Because really this needs to be a global conversation and a multicultural conversation.
That's wonderful. So thank you so much for this incredible conversation. Before we close today, I would love for you to lead us in a practice of some kind to finish our time together.
Okay, happy to do that. And partly what I'll do is use my just to get myself in the spirit of things. Use my Tibetan bell. I hope that the sound will work. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So please do get settled and try to feel the support of your chair, cushion, pillow, floor as metaphorically, the support of the planet Earth that connects us all. And try to lean into it and feel in contact or feel you belong to that support, to that planet and all the life that it holds, you included. Maybe looking at your body, the rest of your body, and trying to invite it to settle in, right? To just try to get aligned with that sense of the grounding of your seat. Letting go of whatever tensions or restlessness and maybe doing any shifting of your body that might help. And maybe now be aware of the breath and invite the breath in, maybe taking a nice long inhale and with the breath, inviting your awareness to gather into your felt sense of being in a living body. Right, so as you're observing the in and the out, and taking especially the opportunity of the in-breath to gather the attention from past and future, from this and that, and to bring it into a felt sense of inner connection with where you feel your body breathing, right? And maybe looking inside the body for, or feeling inside the body for a place where the sense of the breath calls to you, where there's a kind of inviting sense of grounding or rest or stability, or where you can sort of feel into the pulse of your life breath. And as you maybe invite your mind, breath at a time, to settle more and more into that sensation of feeling in touch with the physicality of your breath, the felt sense, you also try to turn your awareness to who or what is noticing the breath. How, right, where is the awareness, where's the observer, where's the part of you that's consciously attending? And maybe I'll invite you to sort of let go of some of the normal chatter that might be in the mind, the normal flow or clutter of thoughts and images and emotions, and try to move toward whatever space of greater clarity or stillness, greater awareness might find in there, to make that kind of your new resting place in the mind and have a really light touch with all the stuff that's floating through your mind. Right, and then we're going to maybe just briefly now take that whatever inner space, greater grounding, like your awareness, your clear awareness grounded on the felt sense of the breath, and felt sense of the breath grounded on your felt sense or physical sense of being grounded on the earth. We're going to try to take that inner space of greater, more stable, grounded awareness and maybe open it into a workspace or a learning space, and into that space, right in the mind's eye, try and invite someone who, the image of someone who sort of has what you want, who inspires in you a sense of, you know, hope, admiration, inspiration, that there's a better way to be human, to be in a human mind, body, nervous system. And that can be a teacher, it can be a relative, it can be a figure that you only know through media or through literature or spirituality. Just try to have that being in mind as a kind of role model or guide, and try to really welcome and engage that being in your mind's eye, and sort of admire their way of what it is that about them that you want. You know, what is their way of being, their peace or presence or kindness or whatever. And also now notice them regarding you with a sense of welcome, with care, with sense of possibility, and maybe seeing through whatever insecurities or suffering you have to a deeper potential within you, for you to have those same qualities that they embody. Right? And try to sort of use their interest, their care for you, their faith in you, their confidence in you, to use what they see in you to try to see in yourself that deeper Buddha nature, if you will, or potential for clarity and care deep in the heart of your being. And maybe ask for their help leaning into that, living from that, integrating that more into your life, to work with the sufferings that you have, to work with the sufferings of others, and to kind of bring a greater sense of wise care to your life and to the world. And then really knowing that this is just a taste, ask that mentor to be part of your path, to be accessible in your heart, and imagine they melt into your heart. And they're always sort of merging with your potential, connecting you to your potential, so that, you know, recalling them helps you taste that. And now maybe just turn back to checking in with your mind and body, how this brief practice of mentor bonding has landed with you. Any thoughts or feelings, maybe anything positive to dedicate to your, you know, your journey, your study and practice, for your own sake and for the sake of all those around you, the whole world. And maybe coming back to just the simple physicality of your breath. And, you know, as I ring, let's close this practice.
Well, thank you so much for the beautiful meditation, and thank you so much for being here today. You are such a tremendous resource in this field, and I appreciate you sharing with us today and everything else you're doing. And so I'd like to point our listeners to your books, as there are some great resources there, in addition to the numerous articles you've published in peer-reviewed publications. Your books are Boundless Leadership, Sustainable Happiness, and Advances in Contemplative Psychotherapy. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sharon. A real joy to be with you. Be well.
Hey, folks. Thanks so much for listening. We would not be here if it weren't for your wonderful presence, attention, and listening. If you'd like to learn more about Joe's work or to get a copy of one of his wonderful books, you can visit nalandainstitute.org, NALANDA institute.org. And for all things Sharon, books, online classes, to get a copy of her latest book, Finding Your Way, you can visit SharonSalzberg.com. This has been the Meta Hour podcast on the Be Here Now Network. May you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, and may you live with ease.